Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in these uncertain times. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds on the Holistic Survival Show. And by the way, be sure to visit our website at holisticsurvival.com. You can subscribe to our blog, which is totally free, has loads of great information, and there's just a lot of good content for you on the site. So make sure you take advantage of that at holisticsurvival.com. We'll be right back.
Now you can get Jason's Creating Wealth in Today's Economy home study course. All the knowledge and education revealed in a 9-hour day of the Creating Wealth Bootcamp, created in a home study course for you to dive into at your convenience. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com.
My pleasure to welcome Elaine Smitha to the show. She is the author of Screwing Mother Nature for Profit, and she has another book as well, and we're going to learn all about them. Elaine, welcome. How are you?
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Now, you're coming to us from Olympia, Washington today, right?
That's true.
Fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit about your book and what inspired it.
Well, yeah, Screwing Mother Nature for Profit is my second book, and I just kind of looked around and thinking about Mother Nature and how we survive because of her, you know, because if we don't take care of Mother Nature, then we're going to be in big, big trouble because we depend upon Mother Nature for our food, for our lifestyle and farming, all these kinds of things that we really need Mother Nature for. And so when I found that some companies were not behaving as I felt that they should in being in business, that we needed to write about it. So that's what I did.
So give us some examples.
Well, Papua New Guinea is the lead into the book. And I've been to Papua New Guinea some years ago. And the natives, of course, live off the land there. And they're quite frugal in their usage of things because they have respect for Mother Nature. Well, then along comes this mining company, and they are mining over there and with total irresponsible behavior, and the sludge is going down the mountainside, and the water is being polluted in the area because the natives often a lot of the natives live on the side of the water when water a lake kind of would come in because there's a lot of water there, and they live on the banks, and so when all this debris was going down the river and coming into their little village. Then this is where that's where they get their water to drink. They bathe in it. I mean, the source for them is water. And so with all this dredging going down the hillside into the valleys where these natives live, they were actually polluting the environment. And the natives got very upset about it. And being primitive as they are, not certainly like we are here in the United States. And what they did, they marched on the mining company's offices there and broke windows. They broke all kinds of things, trying to sort of get even, you know, let them know this is not what the thing you're supposed to be doing. And they did this several times because the mining company continues to do it. And so the people wanted to let them know this isn't working. And so, yeah, they broke computers. They threw things around. I mean, they tried to destroy them so they stop it, you know, but the consciousness of some of these businesses, like this particular endeavor, is not really in Mother Nature's favor, and the exploitation for the money that can be gained is a driving force, and that was the thing that really got me ignited to write the book.
So what are they mining?
they're mining for gold and silver.
And so gold and silver, you know, certainly that's been, people have been mining for that for 5,000 years probably. What is the solution that you propose in the book? You know, and I want to hear some more examples like this, but I just wanted to kind of jump to solutions if we could first. Or are there not solutions proposed and just exposing the problem?
Well, it's just coming from a biological point of view as sustainable. You know, like our bodies are very smart, and the skin of our body is the interface between the outside and the inside. And so that's why when you touch someone or you touch something, you feel it, you know it's there. Well, I take this model and apply it to business, seeing that business needs to be more conscious about their behavior and that their actions are affecting everyone inside, like our body would be. And so I use that as a comparison because it's a viable one and it's accurate. And so I'm hoping that the corporations would wake up and be more conscientious about their behavior and what they're doing to Mother Nature's environment. We only have one planet to live on. We have not found another planet yet to move to. So we have to take care of our planet here. And Mother Nature is our gift for food, for everything that we have, fresh air, all of this. Mother Nature is in charge of all of this. So I would like for these businesses to be more responsible and to take that under consideration when they're doing things.
And how do we get them to be more responsible?
Well, that means that they have to wake up. You know, they have to become aware that they are, and I'm sure that many people in the corporate world are aware that they are not behaving in the right way, but I'm sure it's because that's their livelihood and that's where their money comes from. But I think you have to get the corporate consciousness itself to change the way they do their business.
But you know, what I'm saying, Elaine, is what is going to cause them to do that? I mean, if you're in the mining business, you know what you're doing. I mean, you know your business if that's what you do. Or in any business, everybody knows kind of, it's pretty clear and obvious, I'm sure. It's not an accident, for example, right? That they know what's going on with their business and what effects it has and so forth. How do we get them to change their behavior?
Well, I'm not sure how you can get them to change their behavior except trying to, I think the natives certainly have tried to do that over there, to get them to at least be more conscious of what they're doing. Maybe have a drainage ditch someplace else where it doesn't have to go down into the villages. That could be a way that they could solve that problem without having to.
But even if they did that, it's still going somewhere, right?
Well, the water would be, yes. I mean, you know, it rains a great deal.
When you say, and you're talking about the polluted water, right? The
yeah.
byproduct
yeah.
of the mining.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, that polluted water has to go somewhere. Water doesn't just disappear. It can't be condensed or anything. So what do you do with it? I mean, do you suggest they stop mining? Do you suggest they just store the water in some big reservoir that's self-contained?
They might be able to filter it.
Okay.
Filter the water.
Yeah.
So
okay.
that the natives are not, you know, having to have this polluted water in their areas. I mean, that's one thing they think they can do.
Yeah, okay, so fair enough. They could filter it. And then when business does this, and, you know, I want to talk about some other examples because this is a great discussion, but when they do this, it creates higher cost for the business, and of course that's why they don't want to do it, because they want to keep their costs low, and then that ultimately creates a higher cost for the consumer, right?
Well, probably, but, you know, gold and silver are pretty malleable in terms of pricing, isn't it? And, you know, the businesses can do that quite easily.
Well, gold and silver are commodities, so, you know, they're traded on exchanges, and the price is pretty set and clear. So, you know, certainly if it's more expensive to mine the gold and silver is going to be more expensive to the end buyer of it, whether it be someone using it in electronic devices or belt buckles or jewelry or just buying it for investment purposes. So, okay, so we understand that. So this is the New Guinea example. Were there other examples in New Guinea, or were you looking at other countries as well?
No, I just primarily Papua New Guinea, because that was one that I had the experience with having been there, but I'm sure that there's others that also have that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk nowadays about China, of course. America has outsourced so much of its manufacturing overseas, especially to China, that one of the issues is they say a lot of the companies are going over there because it's cheaper to do business there because there are fewer regulations. So there goes the American jobs, right? But what do you think about that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, I mean, look, businesses are all over the world, and they each have their own peculiarity in terms of their actions and how they are behaving. And all I'm asking is for them to be conscious of the effects of their decisions so that people can do the right thing. Well, I think one really good example is, say, Ford Motor Company. They have their truck assembly plant. They have that the parking area graded so that the water will flow into the into a pond or into a river wherever they have their location there. But what they've also done is they have put on the roof of their buildings, they have put drainage up there as well, so that it drains down and goes under the driveway out to this draining area. And in fact, the top of their truck assembly structures there, they've even made that like a natural environment. So they even have deer up there. So they're growing plants on top, which is helping to keep the environment clean, the air they're breathing clean, and using the water in a really constructive way that goes out where it's supposed to, where it can be flowing into the community. And I think that's very responsible.
Right, right. And you think that really the U.S., like this whole thing I just said about China, I mean, these companies are doing a lot of this in third world developing countries because they can get away with it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and they can't in the U.S. What are your thoughts about that?
About countries being responsible?
Well, yeah, no, about the fact that this is where the companies are going because they're going where they can get away with it, whether it be China or New Guinea or whatever, because the regulations in the U.S. are so stiff in terms of this.
Right. Well, so, yes, they're always going to go where they have the most rewards for their efforts. I mean, that's the way it's been. They're using cheap labor in some of these countries, especially some of the third world countries, and they use the women a lot of times are raped by the men, and they live in a house all together. I mean, it's just so abusive in that regard, and they'll work these workers, especially in China. I've been to China, I've seen their factories, I've been in them, and yes, and they really do work them, and they work them long hours.
So the question there, you know, I've had a struggle in terms of how I think about this. A very good documentary that you would really like is entitled Life and Debt. It's about Jamaica and how the World Bank went into Jamaica. And, you know, the documentary takes the position that they really pretty much they screwed the country over, basically. And how they have these zones and these factories where people are working incredibly long hours, poor conditions, yes, et cetera. But what I keep struggling with is this, Elaine, and I just don't know how to come to terms with it. Maybe you can help me, is that before that, they didn't have any real economic development in their country, and they didn't have any jobs at all. So the people aren't being forced to work there. They're not. No one's holding a gun to their head. They could live, I guess, the old way they used to live as very primitive peoples, like they probably did in New Guinea before this mine came along. You know, so I struggle with that. I don't know what is the right way to think about that. They keep saying that the conditions caused by big globalist industry and capitalism are bad, and they're just not good enough, and it's not fair, and they're doing all these bad things. But no one's forcing those people to work there. The question is not how bad is it compared to, say, the U.S. The question is how bad is it compared to what they had before? I think that might be the right question. Is it improvement on what life used to be, or is it worse?
I think so. I can remember being in China many years ago, and the villages, and, you know, they have limited housing there, and they were cooking outside, had a fire, and that's how they were cooking their food, and even a pot of tea. And so they were living in a very primitive environment. And even, gosh, I was there, as I say, many, many, many years ago, when even like in Shanghai and the big cities, Beijing, I mean, there were no cars on the road. people walked there, and if they were outside at all, I mean, it was just amazing. And of course, now it's flourishing, and they are.
And it's a lot more polluted because of all those cars, right? Yeah.
Yes,
so when were you there in the 80s, for example?
Yes.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Late 70s, I think, as soon as it opened up.
Totally different world nowadays, no question
about
it.
Oh, very much, yes. Yeah. Yes, I was in China last year, so very big difference.
So I mean, yeah, that's a great contrast for you, because a friend of mine, he was there in the 80s, and he saw it the old way just as it was kind of starting to, it was just the beginning of the real changes. Of course, I mean, it was 10 years after Nixon sort of opened China, if you will.
Right.
But what are your thoughts? I mean, is it like looking back and seeing that contrast of how China has changed, would you say that you're pro-globalization and pro-development or anti-globalization and development? Because certainly it wasn't as polluted as it is now, but then again, a lot of the perks of progress weren't there either.
Well, I think that, it's a very interesting question, because when I think about how the whole, I mean, shopping centers now are all over, we didn't used to have shopping centers, and now in China they have big shopping centers, and that's very different and from what it is, what it was before. And people have, I'm sure they have adopted the Western ways, because when you see the pictures of it there now, it's pretty much Westernized. And we had to have, if we went into a school, we went to look at a school and visit a school, and the children were there, presenting a little performance for us to sort of give us a clue as to how the education system was. But we had educators in our group, so they were particularly interested in that. But it's going to, look, we're going to have progress. People are, the thing is, it's no longer in your hip pocket. Now it's all over. It's
the thing. What's the thing? What do you mean?
Well, the modernization, the movement of corporate, the world is now our oyster, so to speak. We are now traveling all over the world, where years ago, if people traveled at all, it was pretty much to see their relatives in the state in which they lived. I mean, the whole system has changed now. We're opened up. We're smarter. Look, we have computers. We never had computers before. And it's evolution. It's the evolution of humanity and civilization. And how it works out is, we hope, will be for the betterment of humanity and Mother Nature, the animals, the trees. But you see, they're going in, they're cutting down these trees. If we don't have trees, we don't have clean air.
Right, but Elaine, that's my question. How do you reconcile that? I mean, you're saying this, on one hand, you're saying this progress is good, the fact that we can travel everywhere and people do much more than they used to, and that's a huge carbon footprint, and people have computers, but in the manufacturing of computers, all sorts
right.
of environmental sins are
occurring.
That's true,
and a lot of them are done in China, too.
So what do you do? What's the solution?
I don't have a solution. All I can do is say, that if we, each person has a consciousness, and how they behave, how they treat Mother Nature on their own, instead of cutting down all the trees, which is happening in South America.
And what are they cutting the trees down for?
Oh, they're cutting the trees down because they want these natives to learn how to build houses and stuff like that. And they're going in also, the natives have been living off the herbs and the native remedies there. That's how they've been able to stay well, because they know what these remedies will do. And Papua New Guinea also has done that, too. And the natives learned how to take care of themselves by the plants that they have around them. And so what the corporations are doing, they're going in and they're cutting down all these things, building houses, making that country and those people look like they belong in America.
Right, right. But there's a question. So do the natives like living in a house better built with those trees they cut down, or do they like, how did they used to live, in a tent or a hut or what?
Well, they would build huts. They would have huts for themselves, and that's what they had in Papua New Guinea. Although in Papua New Guinea, they could build them out of straw and so forth that they had available to them. They would put planks on the floor so that they could be inside and lay down, but they sleep on the boards. That's the way they sleep over there. It's not like you have a soft bed with a mattress that's so cozy to be into. No, they slept on a slab of wood. So, see, my travels have been all focused on underdeveloped countries because I always felt that the Western ways were flooding the market, and it's not going to be long before everything's going to be homogenized, and you will miss this element of humanity and the evolution of humanity. So that's why all my travels have been in direct alignment with the underdeveloped countries.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's interesting, and because you know you got to see it before it totally changes and becomes
exactly,
like you say, homogenized. But the question is this: the natives in South America that you gave the example of, do they like living in a house better, or do they like living in the old way better? I mean, are they resisting the progress? Are you saying it's being forced upon them?
I think yes. I think it's being forced on them.
How's that?
I think because now they're building over there in Papua New Guinea, and I mean it's just different. You know, it's not like the tribal environment that where everybody works together, play together, live together, cook together, eat together. That cohesiveness that you have from a community. Now we go into our houses, and we have to leave our houses to go find a community.
Right. In most cases, I agree with you. You're right, especially in suburban cases, no question.
Yeah.
But are the people in New Guinea or the people in, I assume you were talking about Brazil when you talked about the trees, but it could be anywhere. Are those people not liking that, or do they like it more?
Well, I think that, you mean the people moving into these new houses?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're
well, they're looking for a place to live. We have an overabundance of population, so they have to find some place to live.
Right, but couldn't they still live in the straw hut?
In New Guinea, yes,
well,
they could.
Yeah, I mean, are they what I'm getting at, Elaine, is are they forced to live this Western way, or could they still live
in their... Oh, they're not forced.
Yeah. So what do you do? Not offer them a choice? Or
It's all around them, you know. It's all around them. It's not like Papua New Guinea has changed. It's changing even as we're speaking. And so, you know, companies are going in there, and they're changing the whole system. By maybe in some hinterlands there, they still be able to live like they did before. But, you know, they grow their own food, and they raise animals. And like one, they had a pig, and they fed that pig so that it get really, really fat. And then when they slaughtered it, then everybody had pork. It had a meal out of that pig. So, but they take care of that pig from a little tiny, tiny thing. They put a little rope on one of their hoofs and one of their little legs there, and they parade them around. They have them on a leash, just like you do our dogs here. And so, when it gets big, then they slaughter them, and then the families all get together, and they have a feast. So, a community, I think you have more community spirit because they are so interlinked. And our society today is everybody has their own home or a place to live, apartment or whatever. And many times we don't live with our families anymore. We don't even have them near us. And so we have to find other friends of like mind so that we have somebody to talk to and to share life with. So I think the whole thing is that we're so westernized here in the United States, but it wasn't that way in the early days, in the very early days. The families all stayed together. But now we're spread out all over the world. So things are not the way they were before. And I think the Papua New Guinea will be emerging in a way that probably will emulate the rest of the world eventually.
So is that good or bad?
I like to see the native environment myself, you know. But I tell you what, they get 110 inches of rain a year. So having some place where they don't get so drenched, it would be helpful. You know what I
mean? Right, yeah, yeah. 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 See, you know, I get what you're saying about the sense of community and all of that stuff. I mean, I completely get it. I really do. I think that the richer and more prosperous a culture becomes and the more westernized it becomes, those two are pretty synonymous most of the time, the more isolated and detached it becomes. That's no question about it. But the fact is, even though you personally are interested in that and you like visiting those places and you sort of are nostalgic about that, I mean, you don't live like that. You could live like that in the U.S. or in New Guinea, I assume, you know, if you wanted to, right? It seems like for someone like yourself, it's good that you've noticed these things, but I don't know that you're ready to give up your car and your computer and your conveniences to go live in a straw
hut,
are you?
Yeah. No, but that's not the idea. The idea is that those people have come from that. They've not entered that world like we live in today. You know, they're very primitive, although a lot of them now are getting jobs and in the city, and you know, so they will be emerging in a different way as well as they mature in that environment. So we are already, you know, we're not a native environment anymore here in the United States. We have conveniences, electricity, we have gas. I mean, we have all these advantages, but it didn't start off that way. You know, one little step at a time, one little step at a time.
Right. But, you know, I can't help but think there might have been someone 150 years ago, like yourself, who was thinking the same thing maybe 200 years ago, you know, about as America was sort of being built, if you will, thinking, gosh, now we've got to cut down some trees to build some houses, and that whole sense of community, the concept of the pilgrims getting together for Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, you know, that's an obvious image in everybody's mind. That hasn't happened. And then, gosh, that Henry Ford came along and invented or at least perfected the assembly line. And now people are much more mobile, and the stupid Wright brothers, and, you know, then people could travel. And, you know, I mean, it is just, you know, I gotta give you a little bit of a hard time about that, because I think the sense that you're coming from this like anti-progress viewpoint almost, you know, I mean, I get that being nostalgic about it. I really do. I'm nostalgic about a lot of times in the past during which I didn't even live. I wasn't even alive. But, you know, I see them depicted in television shows and movies and read about them. And it seems nostalgic to me, too. So I understand that.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
So let's talk a little bit about Monsanto and Syngenta.
Oh, Monsanto, they're really evil. They do a lot of, you know, the hybrid seeds. That one's just got
exactly.
My goat, I'll tell you. Yeah. Yeah, tell me about it. Sure.
Well, Monsanto and Syngenta, they're two different companies, and they are genetically altering the plant genes, so the farmers must always forever purchase their seeds to survive.
Yep, they got it. They've got a built-in,
you know,
annuity
Mother Nature
for themselves.
Makes the seeds for us so that we are guaranteed a harvest next season. But these companies want to control the seed acquisition. So they're altering the genes so they cannot reproduce, which forces people to have to buy seeds. Well, that's not the way Mother Nature intended it.
I couldn't agree more. I have big issues with corporations patenting things like the genome and seeds and all, you know, all of this type of stuff. However, just to play devil's advocate on that for a moment, it used to be years ago, before companies like Monsanto came along and did this, that the crops were not as resistant to drought. They weren't as resistant to pests as they are now. And so they're much more hardy, these genetically modified crops and seeds. So Monsanto spent a lot of money to figure out how to do that and to engineer the genome of the seeds. They had to somehow be incentivized to do that.
Well, it's all about money. They want to control the food supply. That's why what they created are Terminator seeds.
Right. Those are hybrid seeds.
They not replicate themselves.
Yeah, I know what they are. They're hybrid seeds instead of non-hybrid seeds. They terminate themselves. They don't regrow. So they build themselves an annuity of new buyers of the seeds. But you'll remember it wasn't very long ago, back in the 70s, when the big concern then was all about what? It was all about famine and that the food supply wasn't hardy enough. There wasn't enough to go around. And now food is plentiful. So
that's true.
Did Monsanto make a contribution to that?
I don't think so. Not whether the one to control who lives and dies, who feeds or not. I don't think that's ethical.
Well, like I said, I agree with you on that, that I have issues with companies patenting natural things like that.
A lot of these farmers killed themselves because the seeds wouldn't grow. And it's forced the farmers to have to buy seeds every single year instead of saving the seeds, which is a normal, godly way that Mother Nature created it.
Right. However, the other side of that argument is, and that's what I'm trying to debate with you here, the other side of that argument is that farmers used to be destitute because the crops weren't hardy enough.
I understand
because
that.
Because if they had a drought, they wouldn't last through it. They're much more hardy now because of these innovations.
Well, that may be true in some instances, but the seeds don't always grow. These Monsanto and Syngenta seeds do not always grow. And so a farmer could plant those seeds and have no harvest.
Well, what do you mean? Well, okay, yeah, I don't know if they don't always grow, but, natural seeds don't always grow either.
I'm not saying always about,
right.
they have not been producing. If those seeds are manipulated, so, there was a big farmer who was, in fact, the seeds had blown over into his field, into his farm field there. And when he found that these manipulated seeds were there, he actually sued them.
Well, no. You mean Monsanto sued the farmer?
No, he sued Monsanto.
Oh, okay. He sued Monsanto because he didn't want the seeds in his farm.
No, because they blew over into his farm, which is not where he wanted. He wasn't planting those seeds. They blew over into his field. So wasn't anything that, the farmer didn't, the other farmer did not plant those seeds, you see. So there was, they blew over into his field, and he sued them and won.
And what was the basis of his lawsuit?
Because they weren't his seeds. They weren't the seeds that he had planted. They were the genetically modified seeds that blew into his farm.
And so was he claiming that he was damaged because he couldn't regrow his crop the next year?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Yeah. But the side benefit is he probably got a hardier crop out of those genetically modified seeds, right?
No, not necessarily, no. They don't really grow as well as the regular seeds do.
Oh, they don't? Because I thought the whole reason that farmers like them is that they're hardier and they grow better.
I don't know that farmers really like them.
Well, I don't think they like the concept of having to rebuy them every time.
Of course not. I'll
agree with you there for sure.
No, yeah. And they have... The harvest is not nearly as hardy as it would be otherwise.
Well, I beg to differ with you there. The claim is that
How come these farmers were killing themselves because the seeds wouldn't grow?
Well, I don't know about an individual thing like that, but all I do know is that and I hate to defend them, by the way. I just want you to know that. I hate to defend Monsanto because I think patenting natural things is just fundamentally I have problems with that. But all I'm saying is that the crops of old, the natural crops, okay, that came from God, they had problems. They weren't drought resistant like the crops are nowadays. They weren't as hardy as the genetically modified crops. And that's the whole point. That's why people like them. That's why we don't have the fear of famine now that we used to. I mean, that wasn't long ago, Elaine. It was in the 70s. I mean, as a little kid, I remember hearing this stuff. Look at all the movies that came out of the 70s, like Soylent Green and all these, movies about the world ending and famine and people starving to death and, how the world can't support more than 3 billion population when we top that number in the 60s. There's this innovation has solved a lot of that problem. I mean, that there is a side to that. And the farmers saying that they don't like it, they don't like the fact that this is now monopolized by Monsanto. And I don't like it either, just so you know. But there are benefits. They've got benefits. And somehow a company like Monsanto had to be rewarded with a patent in this case.
Oh, yes,
to pay for the cost of all that research and development to figure out how to make drought-resistant
crops. How to control the food supply.
No, it's not just about control.
Yes, it is.
It's how to have the food supply yield more food.
Who really farms and he uses the natural seeds, the seeds that he gets from that last crop, he can plant the next year free.
You're right, but you're not listening. That's not the whole story.
You're saying that it's an undependable crop harvest. I got that.
Yeah, okay.
But that's not always the case. Now, you know, could be in one particular area. Maybe it's the soil that's not rich
enough.
Well,
I'm sure there are many factors.
Farmers for years dealt with this. And I think it's just a monopoly that somebody's controlling our food supply.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. This is why I'm upset with the Obama administration for these various laws that they passed. I mean, the former CEO of Monsanto is now Obama's head of agriculture.
I mean, oh,
it's absurd.
Outrageous.
Okay,
outrageous.
You know, he's totally in bed with the corporations, and people act like he's, you know, some fighter for the little guy, and nothing could be further from the truth. But that's why people should be able to locally grow foods, and
absolutely,
you know, to have farmers markets, and the government has attacked.
Open-pollinated seeds to do that.
Well, you can get those seeds. It's not like they don't exist.
Yes, you can get open-pollinated seeds. Yes, you can.
Yeah, they're out there. They're just not as hardy as the Monsanto modified version.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's the benefit. Well, yeah, this is an interesting debate. I'm just trying to get you to see the other side of it, which I don't even always agree with, you know. That's all I'm trying to do, Elaine. But tell people where they can get the book or your two books. What's your other book called?
My book is, the first book is If You Make the Rules, How Come You're Not Boss?
Okay.
Minding Your Body's Business, and it's about self-healing. And I'm sure that the bookstores have it, and they may have to order it, but they do have it. And the second book is Screwing Mother Nature for Profit.
Okay, and where can people get it? Give out your website.
Oh, my website, my website is elainesmithson.com, but they can get it on Amazon, they can get it at any bookstore. It's available.
And have you published it on Kindle, by the way? Are yours available on Kindle?
Yes, it went on Kindle. Watkins Publishing out of London published the book, and they're owned by Barnes & Noble.
Okay, fantastic, because I didn't want you to be cutting down any extra trees, okay?
I know.
To make all that paper for your books, all right? But there's a lot of environmental sins created in making Kindles, too, I'm sure. I have no doubt about that. So it's an ongoing problem. It really is. But Elaine Smith, thank you so much for joining us today. Anything in closing you'd like to say?
Oh, no, I just like for people just to be awake and aware and pay attention, be kind to Mother Nature, be kind to themselves, and give themselves a great big hug. Put your arms around yourself and give yourself a hug.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, Elaine. Appreciate you joining us today.
Okay, thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Likewise.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.